This recording is the property of the Winogren Foundation, cannot be quoted, transcribed, or otherwise rebroadcast without the express permission of the Foundation. This is New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section Lecture Series for November 11th, 2013, Life in Slow Motion, Energetics, Aging, and Evolution in Humans and Other Primates by Herman Ponser.
Great. Well, I'm Leslie Aiello. I'm the president of the Winogren Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you all. Also, if any of you are attending the AAA meetings next week, don't forget that we have a Winogren symposium on Friday evening at 7 o'clock, and we have the only open bar at the meetings. So we can generally guarantee a good attendance. So please come and join us there. Okay, with that, I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to introduce Janice, who will introduce Herman.
Okay, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the fourth anthropology event of the year, the New York Academy of Sciences. My name is Janice Sotokoff, and this is my co-chair, Brian Boyd. And we're very happy to have as our guest this evening, Dr. Herman Ponser, a biological and evolutionary anthropologist at Hunter College. And serving as our esteemed discussant this evening is Leslie Aiello, not only the president of Winogren Foundation, she's also an evolutionary anthropologist who specializes in the evolution of human adaptation, as well as evolutionary theory, life history, and the evolution of the brain, diet, language, and cognition. So, let me see. Dr. Ponser earned his BA at Penn State University and his MA and PhD at Harvard. His research has focused on the linkage of energetics and functional morphology to ecology in great apes and humans. He examines how the energy, physiology, and musculoskeletal anatomy of apes and humans reflect our ecological niche and evolutionary history. He has constructed models and experiments to test hypotheses regarding how selection pressures shape metabolic physiology and functional anatomy in apes, humans, and extinct hominins. He measures metabolic energy expenditure in apes, humans, and other species. With numerical and computer modeling, he explores optimal control and morphological solutions to different selection pressures. In August of 2012, Herman's research was featured in the New York Times twice, first in a piece discussing his research, and then by a piece he wrote himself discussing the effects of dieting versus exercise for weight loss. He was the lead author of a study originally published in PLOS One, a Public Library of Sciences, entitled Hunter-Gatherer Energetics and Human Obesity. And this was based on research done among Hadza, hunter-gatherers of Tanzania, who led a much more active lifestyle than Westerners. Herman and his team's study was able to gather precise information about energy expenditure using a technique, I'm getting this from Herman's own article, that calculates the body's rate of carbon dioxide production, and hence the calories burned per day, by tracking the depletion of two isotopes, deuterium and oxygen 18, in an individual's urine over a two-week period. The findings, I have to say, reading these articles make me feel less guilty for being such a slacker about exercise daily, because they found that despite the higher level of physical activity of Hadza compared to Westerners, metabolic rates remain similar. In other words, moving more does not necessarily burn more fat, which led Herman and co-authors to hypothesize that daily energy expenditure in humans may have evolved independently of culture. In addition to research that continues to investigate daily energy use in great apes and humans, Herman is also involved in the ongoing excavations in the lower Paleolithic site of Dmanisi in the Republic of Georgia. Dated to 1.8 million years ago, Dmanisi contains the earliest evidence of hominids, Homo ergaster, outside of Africa. Dr. Ponser's talk this evening is called Life in Slow Motion, Energetics, Aging, and Evolution in Humans and Other Primates. Will you please join me in welcoming Herman Ponser?
Thank you. If I hold it, does that work? Hey. All right. Thanks so much for the nice introduction, and thanks everybody for being here. I'm reminded for some reason that we were talking earlier about the new finds out of Dmanisi, and I'm reminded of working in my undergraduate lab at Penn State And my undergrad advisor, Alan Walker, used to talk about how scientists were so lucky to be able to play for a career. And especially, I guess, maybe on Veterans Day with a cyclone in the Philippines and all the horrible things going on and reasons to just feel lucky about that kind of line of work. Thanks for joining for an evening of play. So that's what we'll do. We'll work through some fun science. As Janice mentioned, my work looks at energy expenditure in humans and other primates. And the reason is that as an evolutionary anthropologist, I'm interested in understanding how our lineage evolved and why it evolved so radically differently from the other living apes. Humans are weird and different for all sorts of reasons. And tracking those changes and understanding how they occurred and why they occurred and why our biology is so different is just fascinating and the sort of the focus of the broad focus of my research. Specifically, I am focused on how humans and other apes burn energy. And the reason for that is that energy is sort of a skeleton key into all aspects of an animal's ecology and biology. From a biological point of view, life is all about turning energy into kids. And strategies that are better at that proliferate through natural selection, and that's how evolution works. And so if we can understand how an organism burns energy and how a species burns energy, what we're learning is its evolutionary strategy and how and why it has persisted till today. So if we can understand that about ourselves, we can sort of understand something about why our lineage is so different than the other apes. So we're very aware of our energy expenditure when we're out exercising, but we're always burning energy all the time, which is why this room's going to get warm as we all sit here and metabolize away. And one of the things we spend energy on is growth when we're little. And so here's a young female gorilla. She's cooking away, spending energy on growth. And if she is successful at that, she does that successfully, she'll age up and become an adult, and she'll switch to spending her energy on reproduction. And if she does that well and successfully, she'll have an offspring or two or three, and the cycle repeats itself. So energy expenditure isn't just about activity. It's also about all the other critical and important things that individuals and organisms do just to keep alive and to keep life going. From this sort of perspective, humans and other primates are an interesting puzzle, an interesting case of energy expenditure, and an interesting strategy. Energy expenditure, like I just said, is sort of in part and parcel of this pace of life, how fast we grow, how fast we reproduce. And when we look at the pace of life for humans, and we compare it to other mammals, it's very obvious that the human strategy is radically different than most other mammals. And we know this intuitively if you've ever owned a dog or a cat. If you've owned a dog, or you think about their life in terms of dog years, right? Your dog grows up, it's an adult by the time it's one. If it's lucky, it might live to be 10 or 15 years old. It's not going to live past 20. Very sorry to break the news to you if you're a new dog owner and didn't know that already. So we talk about things in terms of dog years, but that actually sort of putting them on our scale confuses the issue. Let's put us on their scale, right? Here's a dog that's 28 dog years old, right? It's a 4-year-old dog, so it's 28 dog years old. It's in its sort of young adulthood. And if we were to look at humans on that same scale, we'd realize just how bizarre human life scale and life, the pace of life is. Here's a 35-year-old in dog years kid, still a juvenile, not anywhere near reproductive age. Here's this kid, just scary enough to his parents, I'm sure, reaching reproductive age at 83 dog years, right? And these parents are in their 200s, and they're not even halfway done, right? So humans are very distinct among mammals in having these extraordinarily long lives, and to put it in this kind of scale makes you realize how long those lives are. And we grow really slowly. We reproduce really slowly compared to other mammals. This dog could have as many pups in a litter as a woman is likely to have in her whole life. And so we have this sort of distinctively slow pace of life, slow reproduction, and we put that all under the rubric of slow life history. So I'll talk about life histories today, and when I'm talking about life histories, I'm talking about that sort of pace and pattern of growth and reproduction across species. Now, humans are not alone in that. It turns out that all primates are slow life history animals. It's a distinct trait for the group. And so here's the kind of plot that we often look at it in the sort of work I do that demonstrates that point. Here we have body mass, so in grams along the bottom here, and reproductive output per year. So this is grams of kid, sort of a funny way to reduce it, right? But this is grams of kid per year. And this is how big you are. This is adult female body size. And every data point here is the mean for a mammal species. And the gray dots are all non-primate mammals, and the red dots are all mammals. And you notice that except for a couple of small-bodied primates, they're all below the line. Primates are all slow. We all have a low rate of reproduction for a given body size compared to other mammals. Humans are over here, distinctively slow. But we're all slow. Primates are all slow. And this has been a big question. You know, why this evolved and why primates are like this has been a big question in evolutionary anthropology for a long, long time. The sort of standard answer for why primates are so different is that perhaps, the argument goes, we allocate our energy differently. So the argument would be that if we imagine your energy budget here in terms of a pie, right? So you can make a pie chart of how you spend your energy, and we can imagine that some slice of that pie is spent on reproduction. The sort of standard way for understanding why primates have such slow life histories is that primates have a different allocation strategy. So they spend less of their energy on reproduction, and a smaller slice of the pie on reproduction means less calories for reproduction, less calories for growth, et cetera, slow life history. That's been the standard explanation. We didn't actually have until recently, and this is the work I'll talk about today, we didn't have data to test the alternative hypothesis, which is that perhaps primates have just radically shrunk their energy budget completely. And the allocation pattern is the same, but the size of the whole budget is very different. And, you know, in addition to just understanding whether which one occurred, the strategy chosen by primates or sort of chosen over evolutionary time by primates has big consequences for how we understand their ecology, their foraging needs, et cetera, down the line. So distinguishing between these two ideas has a lot of implications for how we understand the evolution of primates generally and of ourselves in particular. But to get that kind of data, we need real measurements, empirical data, on the size of those energy budgets, exactly how many calories you're burning every day. And here's the data that we had until pretty recently. This is the universe of data for mammals that we had until about 3 or 4 years ago when my collaborators and I started looking at primates specifically. Here is daily energy expenditure. So this is the size of the energy budget, the size of that energy pie, versus body mass here again. And you notice it's another log-log plot because in biology a lot of things follow sort of power scaling laws, and so they plot nicer if you do that in log-log space. And these are all non-primate mammals. We had a fair number of non-primates, but we'd only had one or two primates. Particularly, we had a pretty good data point for humans. And we notice here, okay, humans are below the line, so it looks like maybe humans have low energy expenditures, but the problem is we only had these kind of humans, right? Humans like you and me. We didn't have many traditional groups represented in that data set, and it raises the question of how reliable that data point is. If humans that in Western societies are just lazy, of course, then that's an artificially low data point. Another thing to point out here is just how much variation there really is and how much evolutionary sort of space there could be for evolving your energy budget one way or the other. For example, if we look at another equally large mammal, this is a springbok gazelle from Africa, its average standard calories a day, 5,800 calories a day. How to compare that? Well, if you are an Olympic athlete in training, or if you are a Tour de France cyclist, you're probably burning something like 5,800 calories a day. In other words, it's a level of expenditure that would be extreme for humans and, in fact, isn't sustainable for more than a few days. until they came up with really good drugs, you couldn't do this for very long without really wrecking your body. In fact, that's what all those drugs do that they take in the Tour de France, is they help you get through the wreckage that causes. It doesn't help you do more work. It helps you not wreck your body when you do it. Anyhow, that's a side point that we can talk about some other time. The point is, with this much distance, right, that's more than twice the amount of energy expenditure that we have, it raises the question, okay, mammals are very different in how big their energy budgets are. It seems very possible that humans and other primates might have evolved these tiny energy budgets as a way of sort of minimizing their energy needs every day and therefore having slow life histories. But we need lots of data for primates. We need more data for humans so that we're not just looking at these weird Westerners, because Westerners are you know, our lifestyle is weird from an evolutionary point of view, very recent and very kind of technologically supported. So we wanted to go out and get those data. And those are the data that I'll talk about today. So the questions I'll cover are, how does primate energy expenditure compare to other placental mammals? Are we a low-energy group? What are the effects of activity or population within versus between species variation? I'll talk about all those issues for most of the talk today. I'll put particular emphasis on the HADSA Energetics project that Janice mentioned. This is a project we did looking at hunter-gatherer energetics in a group of traditional hunter-gatherers in northern Tanzania. I'll talk about that project in a little bit of detail because I think it kind of brings into focus a lot of these issues about activity and population effects on energy expenditure. We'll then use that data to explore the question, is it allocation or throughput? Is slow life histories, slow rates of growth, reproduction, and aging in humans and other primates just due to this metabolic change that's happened over evolutionary time in primates in general and perhaps in humans in particular? And then what I want to try to do towards the end is just briefly, I don't have a whole lot to say here, but I think it's worth kind of wrapping things up by talking about some implications of these data for understanding our own evolution and for maybe understanding our health from a kind of evolutionarily informed perspective. Okay. I want to spend a little bit of time to talk about the way that we get these data, and it's because it turns out the way you get them matters. A lot of people have worked on energy expenditures in different primate groups and in humans, different human groups, and they've done it by estimating energy expenditures based on how active an individual is. So you follow an individual around all day, you tot up how much they walk and how much they lift and how much they sleep, and you say, well, if I put calorie values on each of those activities, I can come up with some sort of estimate of how many calories they burn. That's a great way to start. It's a good way to frame hypotheses, but it turns out to not be accurate enough for the kinds of questions we want to ask here. So instead, what we do here is we use a technique called doubly labeled water. And what we do is we take some water here, and I've labeled the isotopes here. Water, of course, is H2O, right? You all remember your high school chemistry. Water is H2O. And in doubly labeled water, some of the H's are deuterium. They've got a little neutron on them. And some of the O's are O18. And by tagging these are elements, these are isotopes that are stable, they're not radioactive or anything like that. But they're also very rare in nature. So they kind of, it's sort of like a label. It's like food coloring that we're putting on the water that we can measure with a mass spectrometer. So we take this water, we dump it into your body water pool, because we're all just sort of human-shaped bags of water sloshing around. And then we can measure that water over time and measure it for isotope ratio. So if I dump that water into you and I take a urine sample, I'll see there's all sorts of those isotopes in there because I've just dosed you with them. You're going to lose those isotopes as you pee them out. They'll be lost in your urine. You'll also lose the oxygen, and the oxygen only, not the hydrogen, as CO2 that you breathe out, right? So you breathe out CO2, and some of those O's are the tagged O's that I put in before. Of course, you lose water when you pee, and that H and O are lost there. And so over time, what I would see, if I get a bunch of urine samples from you, I'll see the concentration of those isotopes go down, down, down over time. But I'll see that you'll lose the oxygens faster, because you're losing the oxygens not just as water, but also as CO2. So then, if I can figure out how to compare the rate of loss of the hydrogens and the oxygens, I can figure out how much carbon dioxide you're producing and how much energy you're burning. So here's our body water pool in the shape of an orangutan. We dose them full of tagged water. We get our urine samples. We do a bit of math to compare the oxygen and the hydrogen rates of loss, compare those two slopes, and use that to calculate the rate of CO2 production, and there you go. You can't burn calories without making carbon dioxide. It's not possible. Over the long term, your body sorts everything out, and you burn carbon dioxide to burn your calories. Sorry, you produce carbon dioxide to burn your calories. And therefore, we get a nice direct measure of how many calories you've burned by doing this technique. It's called the doubly labeled water method. And we don't have to have you in a lab during this. You can go out living your normal life as long as we get a couple of urine samples here and there over the course of about 2 weeks. So it's a two-week snapshot. It's not just a one-off kind of situation, a one-day or half-day kind of thing. It's basically a half month of measurement. So it's a really good way to get a really good idea of average, truly sort of representative energy expenditure for any individual that we can dose and get pee samples from. A little bit of bragging here. I know that you guys are all wishing that you could do this in your own house. Turns out, if you had 80 grand, you could. This is how much that we get one of these desktop analyzers and do this. I think we're the only anthropology lab in the country, actually, that's doing this for this technique. The rest of these labs are all in nutrition departments and that kind of stuff. So New York is one more thing New York can be proud of, is a doubly labeled water lab in an anthropology department. Okay, so enough methods. Who do we measure? Well, we started this process and project, and I say we because, as I'll show you, none of this is done by me myself. I've been sort of trying to lead the charge and make it happen, but I haven't been without a lot of really important help. The first place we worked at was a place that's now kind of defunct called the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines, with a collaboration with a guy named Rob Shoemaker. And I was talking to Rob about I was up there for another reason, and I was talking to Rob about how fun it would be to do this project and get real calorie measurements for apes, because nobody had done this at all for any apes at all until really recently, and for a very few number of primates, period. And so we just didn't have the data. And I said, Rob, wouldn't it be cool to get this kind of data? And he said, oh, that'd be great. Let's just, you know, come up and we'll do the orangutans at the Great Ape Trust. And I said, yeah, but Rob, the trick is, you know, they have to drink all of the dose, and if they spill anything, it's a real problem. And he goes, oh, that's okay. We'll just put it in sugar-free iced tea. They love that stuff. And sure enough, man, you put a little bit of this water. I mean, it's only sort of about, you know, it's a wine glass full of doubly labeled water. And it just tastes like water. It's just regular water. You can't tell the difference. And they loved it. Sure enough, sugar-free iced tea. And I said, but Rob, the real trouble is that then you have to get urine samples. And, you know, how do you get urine samples from a 400-pound orangutan? It sounds like a joke. Very carefully, exactly. Thank you. What I really want to talk to you today about is about Sony RealPlayer. Thank you. Anyhow, so Rob said, that's no trouble at all. We'll just ask him. Right? And that's because Rob does some really cool research on language and symbol recognition and understanding in orangutans. And so he literally, he plays games with these orangutans every day. They're cognition games it's research, of course, but the orangutans don't know that. They just think it's a game. And because it's really just language is the interaction, you can say, hey, AZ, come over here and pee in a cup. And AZ will literally walk over and pee in a cup. Kenobi, see, and the other thing about orangutans is their feet and their hands are equally dexterous, right? They're quadrumanous. And so the only trick was a couple of the females liked to hold the Dixie cups themselves while they peed with their feet. And so we spilled a couple of samples. But overall, it was entirely positive. And it was the first data that anybody had ever gotten on any ape energy expenditures at all. Really exciting stuff. So that got published a couple of years ago. The next project, chronologically anyway, was the work that Janice mentioned, and I'll talk a little bit more in detail about it. I won't talk about it too much right now. But it was in these a human hunter-gatherer group in northern Tanzania with the Hadza. We've since done Shafox in the Wild. We've done Gorillas in Lincoln Park Zoo with Steve Ross, who's just absolutely fantastic. All these collaborators are just wonderful. We've done Chimps and Bonobos, both in zoos and in these very wild setting sanctuaries in Africa. We've done One Lonely Island Swamp Monkey in Lincoln Park Zoo. We've done marmosets in Zurich. We've done ring-tailed lemurs. This actually was completely done. I didn't have any part of the data collection on this. Was with Matt O'Neill and Kathleen Muldoon. I'll show you the data, though. They were kind enough to join us as we were getting these data together at Duke Lemur Center. And as it happens in the last couple of years, people have been excited about this technique, and so there's been a couple other data points collected, mostly lemurs, from a couple of lab studies that aren't really, they're very biomedical sort of oriented. But anyway, so we now have a pretty good data set of total energy expenditures, calories spent per day, in a bunch of primates. And this goes from everything from mouse lemurs, the tiniest primates that fit in the palm of your hand, up to adult silverback gorillas, which literally do weigh about 400 pounds. So this is the whole size range of the order primates. It's the entire taxonomic range of the order primates. So even though it's only 17 species, there's about 200 species of primates, depending on how you split the different groups. So this is only 17 species, but it's a good wide coverage of the order in general. So what do the data look like? What do they look like? Here's what they look like. Here is that daily energy expenditure. Again, and DEE, by the way, is daily energy expenditure, if you see that in other graphs. Calories per day, and these are the comparative data I showed you at the beginning of the talk. These gray points are all non-primate mammals. And here's body size versus calories. If we put the primates on top of there, look, everybody's below the curve. Who's this lonely non-primate you're asking? That's a three-toed sloth. That's an aardwolf. That's a red deer. So animals that we know are actually metabolically low-energy animals are the only ones that are near the primate line. Primates seem to be off on their own in the wilderness here on this graph. It's a very strong, statistically very, very strongly significant difference. And your cocktail hour factoid to share with your friends is that primates burn about 50%, only 50% of the energy that other animals spend. Again, on these log-log plots, everything looks like it's, you know, it doesn't look like anything's too far away, that this variation doesn't look that extreme. But in fact, here's how much sort of difference is hidden in that plot. If you were a human and you wanted to get your daily energy expenditure up to just what's average for a mammal your size, then on top of everything you do every day, you'd have to also run a marathon just to get your energy expenditure up to average for a mammal, right? It's an enormous difference. As we'll see, that is true not just of us lazy New Yorkers, but actually lazy St. Louis people, which is where most of the human data are from, but also I lived in St. Louis, and I don't take issue with that. So the Hadza are also here, and the Hadza are the same deal. For a Hadza hunter-gatherer, they're already really active. To get their energy expenditure up to just average for a mammal, they'd have to run a marathon a day on top of what they're already doing. That tells us right away that these differences are not differences in activity level. These are differences in just the baseline metabolic rate, how fast your engine is running over the course of the day. More evidence for that is the fact that when we compare captive versus wild populations of primates, we don't see any difference. So here, if you can tell in the back, the white dots in the middle indicate captive, the full pink dots indicate wild, and everybody's on the same line. And if you do the stats on it, there's no difference captive versus wild primates. We put this into review, which hopefully it'll be coming out relatively soon. And the reviewers said, that sounds crazy, I don't believe you. That there's no difference between captive and wild animals. They said that you should go and get more wild data, and there just aren't any more wild data. But what there are very careful measurements of how much primates in the wild eat. So we can look at how many calories orangutans and chimps and baboons and spider monkeys and gorillas eat in the wild. These are studies that have been done super carefully, and the data are solid. And here's what that looks like. Here's that primate line again. Here are all the wild intake data from spider monkeys, baboons, chimps, orangutans. Gorillas are a bit high, but that's probably mostly the way the data were collected. the intake data fall right on top of the doubly labeled water data. So completely different methodology, completely wild populations, and the data are in complete harmony. So this is really surprising. Not only are primates really low energy expenditure, but things like whether you live in a zoo or live in a jungle don't seem to matter. That's really surprising to us. And maybe it's surprising to you too. Let's explore that a little more deeply with that HADZA hunter-gatherer data. The reason we went to get these data in the HADZA was that we were very sure, going into it, that hunter-gatherer populations would have very high energy expenditures, and therefore, if we want to know about human energy expenditure and human metabolism and human evolution, we have to measure hunter-gatherers because they're the ones that are most like the living conditions in which our bodies evolved. And we thought that lifestyle would be really, really important for pushing energy expenditures around. Well, we went through a lot of work to get the permits and the funds and everything and the support and went out to work in HADZA land. Where's HADZA land? Well, it's in this part of Africa. Here's Tanzania, and this box blows up that region. You go to Arusha, drive to Karatu, take a left, and go out into the bush and into the area around Lake Eyasi. And there are a number of traditional HADZA camps there. We worked in two of them, Sitako Camp and Sengeli Camp. And we were there for about a month, a little under a month at each of the camps. The measurement period is about a two-week measurement period, like I talked about before. And here's the sorts of, I'll talk about the details in a second, the methods in a second. The people we worked with are, again, HADZA traditional hunter-gatherers. There are some HADZA that have moved into villages or are farming now, but the traditional HADZA who are following this the old ways are still hunting and gathering, getting all of their food from the wild. They don't farm. They don't have any electricity or plumbing. They live in grass huts in the middle of the savanna. The women gather plant foods, a lot of tubers. This woman is digging up wild tubers in hard, rocky ground with a kid on her back. Pretty typical day in the life for a HADZA woman. The men hunt for game, and they collect wild honey as well. This is Isaiah. He's just come back from kicking a bunch of lions off of a kudu kill, because the HADZA are at the top of the food chain in that part of the world. They don't take anything from anybody, including lions. And so he's got his kudu leg here as his buddies had other parts of it coming back to camp. So the men hunt, the women gather, very kind of textbook hunting and gathering traditional society. No tools, no vehicles, no guns, no anything. Everything that they have, they can make with their bare hands from wild materials. The men hunt with bows and poison-tipped arrows. We measured calories per day using doubly labeled water. This is me freaking out that he's going to spill some because then it's all over. He didn't, of course. We did activity levels with the GPS unit. So they all wore the kind of the GPS units that you see people jogging around Central Park with. They wore them during the daylight hours for the two-week study. People ask, well, didn't they get annoyed? Yes. They got annoyed with the heart rate monitors, as anybody would. But they loved the GPSs because they're fun. And they'd come back and they would have turned them off like at 10 o'clock in the morning. And we'd say, did you touch the buttons? No, man, no, I didn't touch anything. Yeah, okay. Anyway, they're really wonderful folks to work with, super generous with their time. It was a treat to work there. We also did some resting and walking VO2 energy expenditures using a mask-based energy measurements that give you sort of, you know, the amount of energy spent over minutes or hours to look at resting costs and walking costs. So these are the first real empirical measurements of hunter-gatherer daily energy expenditures ever. People have done a lot of estimating, but they haven't done a lot of measuring. So we were excited to get these data, even though they didn't work out like we thought they would. So here's a data plot similar to what I showed you before for mammals. Here's a body size versus daily energy expenditure. I've, instead of just pure body mass here, I've subbed in fat-free mass because that turns out to be the best size measure, the best, most predictive size measure for energy expenditure across for humans and other animals. And now, instead of each data point being a species average, now each data point is a person. So the white, the open symbols are women, and we've got over 100 women there. The closed symbols are men, and again, over 100 men. And the gray data points are all folks from the U.S. and Europe. So these are the same exact methods as we used with the Hadza. When we lay the Hadza over top of this, they fall right in the exact same cloud of points that Westerners fall into. So here are the Hadza men in red and the Hadza women with the open circles. Look at the trend line here for you stats folks out there. That's the that gray trend line is the U.S. women's trend line, and there's Hadza women basically clumped around that trend line. So in other words, the Hadza women are exactly what you'd expect in terms of their energy expenditure for women their size. It doesn't matter what population they're from, Europe, the U.S., Hadza, they're all the same in terms of their energy expenditure. If you do the stats on this, there's no difference in terms of, you know, we can control for age, for sex, for body size, all these things. We controlled for everything we could find, and there is just no difference. Here's... So that's a difference in slopes, not a difference in means. And if you can run the stats either separately for men and women or singly just for the population. Either way, you get no difference between the Hadza and Westerners. It's interesting that with a big enough data set, you can show a difference in slope between men and women, and that's any population. That's the U.S. actually drive that difference. And why that is, I think that's telling us about body composition as you get bigger. So a 200-pound man is made of different stuff, literally, in terms of the proportions of different organs, proportions of how much body fat's there, proportions of skeleton versus viscera, than women are. So I suspect that's driving the difference in scaling, but it actually hasn't been explored enough. So that's a hypothesis. Sure. Yeah. We didn't include anybody who was over a BMI of, I think, 30 or 35. So these are healthy folks. If I were to put really obese people in, it actually would be, they would be all over here because obese people have not just a lot of mass, but also just because they have a lot of muscle mass to carry around the obesity, they also are here. So it wouldn't, in this data plot, there's no what are called morbidly obese people in this data plot because I wanted normal physiology against normal physiology. If you include them, you still don't get a difference. Sure. I don't know. Are we doing questions?
No, not yet.
Okay. Sorry. We're not doing questions yet, apparently. This is body. This is the same sort of plot, only this is body mass versus DEE. And I have, because I don't have fat-free mass, instead I just have total body mass. And notice here if I have just body mass, the male and female cohorts are actually collinear. Closed symbols are men, open symbols are women. Only here, each data point is a human population. So, and they're split into male versus female cohorts. And the Hadza women cohort and the Hadza men cohort are right in line with where they ought to be. And this is a global population sample, 98 populations across the globe, Asia, Africa, Europe, South America, North America. High socioeconomic status, low socioeconomic status, all over the globe, everybody's basically the same. And certainly the Hadza are the same as other market and Western economies. So, how do they do it? Everybody says, oh, well, that makes sense. They're more efficient. Well, it depends on what you mean by more efficient. If by more efficient you mean that they can do a task that if you were doing a task and they were doing the same task, that they would do it more cheaply, that's not true, as it turns out. We actually measured a very common task that you do and that they do all the time, which is walking. And if we look at how much energy it takes them to walk a kilometer versus you, and this is with those mask-based measurements, this is me with my zero carrying angle because I didn't get enough vitamin D growing up or something like that. Here's minimum walking cost, Hadza versus Westerners. The Hadza have the exact same cost per kilometer walking as we do. Their resting metabolic rates are slightly low, so perhaps there's some efficiency showing there, but basically, statistically, they're very similar, although we don't have enough statistical power to test if there could be like a small difference. But it's not a big difference. So are they more efficient? I don't like to use that word because as far as we can tell, they aren't doing more for less. They're doing less for less. So rather than spending their energy on things like inflammation response, the kind of things that gives you heart disease, overactive immune response, anabolic metabolism, like tissue growth and that sort of thing, rather than doing that, which what U.S. and West and other Western groups can do because we're energy rich, they spend their energy perhaps on physical activity and spend less on those other things. There's some evidence for this from comparisons of things like testosterone levels in traditional versus Western groups. Testosterone is a hormone that grows tissue, right? When you grow muscle, especially men, that's driven in large part by testosterone as an anabolic steroid. We know that groups like the Hadza, their testosterone levels are actually lower than the West, and that might be a trade-off their body is doing internally to sort of build less tissue. That's a hypothesis. We don't have the data to test that in this particular group. We want to get that data next. But for now, that's my hypothesis for you to chew on, and we can argue it out. A couple other data points to think about with the Hadza is let's look at their diet. It'll be of interest to some folks here. Here are the two camps we looked at, and here's the calorie breakdown, where they're getting their calories from. A fair amount from meat, a fair amount from honey. And so if we look at the calories from meat and honey, it not insubstantial. And that's interesting because a lot of models and ideas for why U.S. and Westerners get diseases like cardiovascular disease or diabetes are based on this idea that our diet is too rich in meat or too rich in simple sugars. And perhaps it is. But here's a very healthy traditional group that doesn't have those chronic diseases that eats a fair amount of meat and a fair amount of simple sugar in terms of honey consumption. Just something to consider, another sort of thing to work on next. I don't have more to talk about with that today, but just something to consider. Again, we suggest, this doesn't get you off the hook for doing exercise, by the way. I'm not arguing that you shouldn't exercise. You absolutely should. And here's what we think is going on and why you should. Here's daily walking distances. Women walk a bit less than men do, 5.6 kilometers a day versus 11.5 kilometers a day. But women do it with a child on their back and carrying tubers and water. So they work their butts off. Men and women both do. And, again, we hypothesize, and this has been thrown around before in other studies, that by spending energy on things like physical activity rather than on things like inflammation response, you can save your arteries, for example. And so here's percentage of the population with hypertension. These are data that we've collected subsequently, not these summers, but since then with the Hadza. And yeah, they have a little bit of heart disease, a little bit of hypertension. Most of this is very low stage 1 hypertension. But compared to the U.S., in the little black bars, their rates of hypertension are much, much lower. So traditional groups have less chronic disease, probably because they're active. So they're not skinny because they're active, but they're less sick probably because they're active. That's a hypothesis. All right. To get kind of back to the questions and sort of begin to bring these threads together, as I've shown, I think we can say pretty confidently that primates are low-energy mammals. We spend about 50% of the energy every day that you'd expect for a mammal our size. The effects of lifestyle are surprisingly small. Going into that Hadza project, the reason that we got the support to do it was that we were very sure, as were the people who thought we should do the project, that we'd see the Hadza jump way up off the charts in terms of energy expenditure. And the question was, how high? Right? We wanted to know what that difference was. Turns out, even more interestingly perhaps, there's no difference between lifestyles. That was really surprising and something that we want to work on next. Does the low energy expenditure of primates explain their slow life histories? And this is a pretty short answer. Let's look at the data. Here's body size again versus reproductive rates or growth rates, grams per year of growth, grams per year of reproduction. And like before, gray is non-primates, red is primates. And look how the primate line is shifted below the non-primate line. Well, okay, but we've done these graphs versus body size. And if we really want to make the sort of the metabolic prediction, the energy based prediction. We wouldn't plot these life history variables versus body size. We'd plot them versus daily energy expenditure, right? We'd plot them versus the sort of number of calories available each day for these tasks. And when we do that, this is estimated DEE, the primates zip right back up with everybody else. So we basically explain this big gap that we see when we compare primates to other mammals by plotting these life history variables against energy expenditure rather than body mass. What about aging, right? What about living longer, which primates do compared to other mammals? Well, here we have to think about how metabolic rates ought to affect aging. And one idea that's been out there for a long time and has been sort of argued back and forth is that metabolic rates and metabolic work in general is actually potentially harmful for your body. Every time you burn, every time you break down the fuel you need to make ATP in the oxidative reduction cycle, you have the opportunity and you to make what are called reactive oxygen species or free radicals. If you are if you buy foods at Whole Foods or Trader Joe's that say they have antioxidants in them, those antioxidants are chemicals in the food that hopefully reduce the effects of these free radicals and stuff. So those antioxidants are you're consuming them if you are or if you care to deal with this metabolic damage that your body does every day. Whether it works, I have no idea, but that's the marketing anyway. So from that point of view, the rate at which your cells burn energy ought to tell us about how fast they accumulate damage and therefore how fast you wear out and die. And so rather than plotting maximum lifespan here against body mass, we would want to know what your maximum lifespan is against the inverse of your metabolic rate. The prediction being that this daily energy expenditure over mass, your cellular metabolic rate, ought to be a better predictor of how long you live. And sure enough, for somebody who works in these big mammal comparisons, this is exciting stuff. You get these really high lifespans. Look how much they're up above the other line, and you get them to sit right back down with the other mammals. Which is to say, you explain the huge gap that you get in dog years versus people years by looking at it through the lens of metabolic rate rather than just pure body size. So that's fun. That's exciting. Makes me happy. Okay. So is slow primate life history related to energy expenditure? Yes. Moving on. Implications for evolution and health. And again, just to sort of wrap things up and maybe tie some loose ends together and throw out some ideas for discussion. Some of the big points from this work, I think, are that life history clearly is shaped through energy throughput. I mean, I don't think that it's a coincidence that when we plot these big life history variables against energy throughput in primates, they look just like every other mammal. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that that's telling us something about how life histories are shaped. And it gives us another way in to try to understand the evolution of humans and other primates by giving us other variables to look at and other sort of physiological mechanisms to explore. So that's exciting. Our slow growth and long lives are basically well explained by the fact that humans and other primates have low rates of energy throughput. Full stop. This isn't to say that that allocation isn't still going on, right? It doesn't have to be either or. It doesn't have to be throughput or allocation. The fact that we spend so much on our brains, for example, because we're such a big brain species, means that we have less energy available for other things, and surely that's tinkering and playing with the sort of overall human energy strategy, as Leslie and others have worked on before. So that's definitely a piece of the story, but I think some of the broad differences can be linked to throughput as well. It gives us another thing to look at. This was the data from both the captive versus wild comparisons, but also the HAZA data, that evolution seems to be driving daily energy expenditures much more than lifestyle. So, you know, in the same way that when we look across the world, we see people are generally the same height, generally the same weight, even though they have radically different lifestyles, we can add to that, people are generally the same metabolic rates. Even though they have very different lifestyles, the bodies adjust. It seems to be another one of these sort of set points that your body likes to find and works very hard to even things out so that you are at your set point. Is there variation within a species? Absolutely. There's people who have high metabolic rates or low metabolic rates, just like there's tall people and short people. But overall, there doesn't seem to be big effects of lifestyle across populations, between populations. And primates, whether you're in a zoo or in the wild, are only burning 50% of the energy of other mammals. The implication for humans is that obesity is due to gluttony and not sloth, right? If gaining weight is eating more calories than you burn, and the amount of calories that you burn is more or less fixed, well, then we know where the problem is, right? It's the calories coming in. Exercise is still really important, and that's one thing that when the New York Times covered our piece, which was really, of course, exciting and fun, that they did that, they didn't kind of... We said this very clearly in the paper when we wrote it, and I actually said it in a little piece I wrote for the New York Times, too, but people didn't read that part. And they said, how can you dare tell people not to exercise? You're going to kill everybody, and are you sponsored by McDonald's? And all sorts of really funny things. No. You don't misunderstand me. You still need to exercise. Well, you don't, but you'll die earlier. You're just not going to, you know, a lifestyle change with more exercise isn't going to by itself make you thinner necessarily. But it'll do other good things for you. Things we're working on now, in the last couple of years, and I'm very happy to say and very proud to say that Wintergreen has actually helped fund some of this work, is to look at whether or not humans and other primates differ in terms of energy expenditure. We have relatively small sample sizes right now for the other apes. We have a big human sample, but we don't have huge data sets for the other apes. And so to do those kind of careful comparisons across species, we need the good data sets. We need proper sample sizes. And Wintergreen has been just fantastic helping support that work to make it happen. Preliminarily, and this is just, we don't know how it's going to shake out, but right now it looks like humans might have a slightly increased metabolic rate compared to the other apes, particularly compared to gorillas and orangutans. I just throw this up there for fun. I don't put too much weight on this now because the sample sizes aren't very big. But if it's true that in our lineage, among all the other things that have changed in humans, we've also increased our metabolic rates to be able to fund. You can think about it like the metabolic funding for all the things you want to do. You can fund a larger brain. You can fund higher reproductive rates, which humans actually have. Humans in traditional groups reproduce, have kids more often than apes do in the wild. So this is suggestive that this might be a really important kind of piece of the puzzle for humans, this accelerated metabolic rate that might be, a really important piece of how we got to be the weird, active, big-brained animals we are. So with that, I'll say thank you. A lot of this work was very collaborative, and thank you for the funding, especially Wintergreen, who's been kind enough to host us here tonight as well. Thank you.
Now introduce Leslie Aiello to serve as our discussant.
You can go sit down.
Okay.
If you hold off with the questions for 2 or 3 minutes, I'm not going to be long. But believe it or not, this was a human evolution talk. You might not have recognized it. And I've been in human evolution since the 1960s. In fact, thinking back, I took my first course in human evolution in 1963. And 1963, for those of you who know about human evolution, was the year that Louis Leakey announced the fossil Homo habilis. Before that time, we had australopithecines, which are the little brain skulls on the outside here. Australopithecines evolved into Homo erectus. Homo erectus evolved into Neanderthals, and ultimately out at the other end came us. It was all bones and stones. And what the sea change has happened since the 1960s is first a much greater knowledge of the fossil record. In fact, the last time I looked, there were something like 22 or 25 different species that were recognized over the last 4 or 5 million years in the human line. We know much more about the archaeology. But what's really important is the other information that's helped to inform us. And it's not only Herman's side on energetics, but it's also the wonderful DNA record. Now, from my own point of view, I think the energetics has been amazingly important. And if you look back into the record, it was really not much earlier than the 1990s that people began thinking about what it really was like to be humans. You don't evolve bones. You don't evolve stones. What you do is evolve life histories. How many kids you get into the next generation, how long you live, it's all tied up in what's called your life history. Now, in the early 1990s, there was a fellow from Northwestern called Bill Leonard who did some wonderful early work. And basically what the take-home message was is that this large brain we're carrying around costs us an awful lot of energy. In fact, for every gram of sort of muscle tissue, your brain costs 20 times more. I mean, it's terribly expensive to carry around these large brain sizes. Now, personally, I got involved in this in the mid-1990s, and it was one of those totally fortuitous things where somebody asked me to write an encyclopedia entry on energetics. And I didn't know anything about it at the time. But there was no one else to write the encyclopedia, and my boss was the one who was the editor, and I had to come up with it. Now, at that point, what the big question was is where humans got the energy to run this high brain. And there was this one hypothesis that we just ate higher quality food. It gave us more calories. But at that point, what the problem was is our basal metabolic rate was exactly the same you'd expect for a non-human mammal of our body mass. But we were carrying around this tremendously expensive big brain. And the question was, where did that energy come from? And by doing a lot of graphs like Herman showed you, what we found was that we had a very small digestive tract. And this has become known as brains and guts in human evolution. Because what you get up here, you have to lose down here. And the only way you can do it is by eating a high-quality diet. Now, we tried to publish this in Current Anthropology, which is the journal that, of course, the Wennergren Foundation owns. And I had a horrible time getting this paper published because the social anthropologist who was the editor at that time, who happened to be Adam Cooper, said it was too scientific. Nobody would ever be interested in it. And I sort of feel that I have my sweet revenge because it's still one of the most highly cited papers in the journal. And last year it was the most highly cited paper in the journal. Now, the field has moved on much more since that time. This was, over 20 years ago now. But there's a tremendous interest in actually what drives human evolution and why we and how we got to where we are now. Now, in just a few seconds, let me take you on a trip through 5 million years of human evolution. Because if you start back 5 million years ago and you saw a human ancestor in the distance out there, just like my husband is standing there staring in, he would be at this, about the size of the guy right here. And we were talking about this early because you were small, you had the small brain size. And you lived like that up until about 2 million years ago. So you had 3 million years of being a bipedal ape. And then all of a sudden, and it really does seem to be all of a sudden, things began to change. The brain began to expand. Our body proportions changed. So rather than having short legs and long arms, we had longer legs and shorter arms. And if you plot brain size, you really go ticking along at about 400 cubic centimeters for 3 million years, as much as we have the evidence. And then it pops up to about 700 cubic centimeters 800 cubic centimeters, and then it drifts along for another million years, and the brain size increases again to the modern size. The whole question is that what has allowed us to evolve this big brain size is exactly what Herman's talking about. In order to support that large brain size, you need the energy, you need the food, and it's a balance between how much energy you expend when you grow, how much energy you expend when you reproduce, how much you're going to put into supporting this huge brain size, and how long you're going to live. And what's fascinating right now is this balance between the life history, the brain size, the human adaptation, and trying to understand at each step along this human evolutionary ladder, what was going on, what the cost benefits were, and why we happened to come out at the end where we're walking around with these large brain sizes and living the type of lifestyle we have today. So what I'll do is leave it with this. There were lots of questions people trying to answer while Herman was talking. So